Welcome to McFly's Movie House, a weekly podcast that delves into cinema's hidden gems, celebrating forgotten classics and emerging filmmakers while fostering an inclusive film narrative. I'm your host, Marta Georgievich, and I'm excited to have you over. Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of McFly's Movie House. I'm your host, Marta McFly, and before we get into things today, I just honestly want to say thank you all so much for being here from the start. This has been a long time coming, and I know I've babbled on long enough in the teaser episode, so I think we should probably just get into things today. When I was thinking for my very first episode, I was really wanting to do a spotlight on a filmmaker, and honestly, Ingmar Bergman seemed to be the most obvious pick for me. I have seen so many of his films. I adore all of them. And ultimately, it's just his way of discussing the human condition and searching for the meaning of life that, for me at least, leaves me with so much introspection. But all of this to say, for my very first guest, picking somebody was very, very easy. The person invited here on today is honestly in the movie content creation space, probably the biggest Bergman advocate I know. He's so well versed in his filmography, maybe even more than me. But that is Seth Mullen-Feroz from Seth's Film Reviews. He also runs the successful and amazing Real Talk podcast. Seth, if you want to introduce yourself, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for inviting me on. I think, like you said, like, we're people that speak about Bergman quite a lot. There's not many of us, I would say, no. Like, in the space in general. But yeah, so I run social media, film stuff, I think. Obviously, we have a podcast, like you said, called the Real Talk Podcast, mm-hmm. which we obviously do the similar thing that what you're going to be doing, reviewing films, directors, whatever. And I kind of just talk about film. I don't really know what else there is to say. I don't really do anything special. Just a Bergman specialist, some might say.
A Bergminophile.
That's great. I like it. Thank you. I don't actually know if I've watched more Bergman than you. I think you might have watched more than me now, because I know you've watched a few recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm sitting at around 22.
I think I might be at 20. I think I might be at 22 as well, actually.
Well, there you go.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're similar, but to break down the episode for you and for, I guess, everybody listening, I thought it would be interesting to each pick five Bergman movies that we love, but the catch is that they have to be from different periods of his career, which is honestly a sprawling career. It started in 1946 with Crisis, and then it ended in 2003 with Saraband, and I believe that was 3 years before his death. But yeah, you feel free to chat about why you love the movies. If you want to add context as to what was going on in his career at the time, by all means. How does all that... Oh, and we also have honorable mentions. I should mention that too. So for each one, you have your pick and you have your honorable mention.
Yeah, so I'll be honest, I have kind of cheated a little bit, because they're different times-ish. At least like a few of them are. But there's like two that are around about the same, because I have like select favorites and I wanted to touch on each of them. But there's a few, because the issue is, I feel like with Bergman's filmography, his catalogue, there's not really that many I hold dearly from the earlier stages, you know, from the kind of the mid to late 40s to mid 50s-ish. And there's a few back in the late 50s, like The Magician, for example, which I really, really liked. But it's really where it gets into kind of the 60s and then obviously the early 80s with what we'll speak about. But I feel like it's just the 60s. That's where like the majority of them are what I love. So I had to kind of pick a couple from there anyway. But
we're in the same
boat. I tried
to
stretch them out a little bit. Yeah, I've tried to stretch them out a little bit.
Good. But before we do that, I do quickly want to ask you, and making an effort to ask everybody that comes on, what have you watched recently that you recommend for everybody else to check out?
Yeah, so I watched... I think you actually commented on one of my Letterboxd reviews. I watched some films from A Pitch at Pong Wirrastackle. Really difficult one to say. A Thai director who is very, very renowned in these kind of slow cinema community. One that I hadn't seen any from before. I watched four of his films kind of the past week or so. Really, just really interesting. Very much, you have to be in the right mindset. It's very similar to like a Tarkovsky, that kind of, you have to be in the kind of mindset to really appreciate it. You know, like, he's very much a sensory director in the way that he uses sound. It very much relies on that. So my kind of plan was to go into as open mind as possible, you know, pair of headphones on, and I watched Memoria, which is the one with Tilda Swinton, who was like one of my favorite actresses. And the really like amazing one I watched was Uncle Boonmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, which is just an incredible, incredible film on grief and memories, and one that I would definitely recommend to check out. Apart from that, a couple of things. Like, I'm a big Michael Mann. I watched Heat the other day. Obviously, we reviewed that on our podcast, and, you know, that's just, it's Heat. It's amazing. I finally watched Phantom Thread for the first time as well. Loved it. So good. Probably one of my favourite from PTA. Watched The Banshees of Inisherin, which is like my sixth or seventh time now, I think. Just my favourite of the decade. If you haven't seen it, obviously make sure you do. And that's kind of about it. Oh, and obviously I watched Poor Things today. Got back from watching that, which was, yeah, really interesting. Probably the most visually pleasing film of, well, 2024 for me, but I guess I kind of include it within 2023's range. Just truly incredible from a visual standpoint. I do think, and I obviously said this in my review, that some of the commentary seems very male gaze to me, and quite superficial, successful, but at the same time kind of juvenile in the way it was presented, just for me. But I think that, I mean, Mark Ruffalo, who I've always liked, people hate him, same, but I've always quite liked him. I know, like, George and Cam from my podcast there. Oh, no, sorry. George and Tyler, they're not big fans of him. Mm-hmm.
Nobody is.
I know, it's weird. I think he's great. I really like him. And then, obviously, Willem Dafoe is incredible. But yep. I thought that, like, the way that Yorgos manages to compose the perfect image and just the colour utilisation as well was just incredible. Mm-hmm. I think, I said this in my review, you could literally pause that film at any time and you would have one of the best frames of the last decade by far.
Absolutely. It's
such a visual marvel. I think I need to, I mentioned to you obviously before we recorded, I need to watch it a couple of times because there's a lot to it, you know. But yeah, I also watched Nostalgia as well because I know I spoke to you about Tarkovsky before. Very back and forth relationship with him. That was my favourite so far.
It's mine too.
Is it really? Because a lot of the people I spoke to, even Tarkovsky fans, say that that's kind of one of their lesser ones in terms of, you know, his filmography.
I loved it.
Did you give it a 5?
Yeah. I honestly, though, I've given, yeah. I think most of his movies I've given a 5 out of 5. It's only Ivan's Childhood I have it a, no, that may be a 5 as well. Shit.
That's a 2 for me currently. That's literally a 2.
What? You've got to rewatch.
I do think, and I said this in my review, that, like, initially I was like, okay, because Nostalgia is very similar to, like, Mirror, for example, in the way that he uses memories, where he uses dreams and, like, personal reflections from Tarkovsky himself. And that's kind of why I hated Mirror when I watched it. But then it makes me think that I like Nostalgia, so surely I'd like Mirror. It's very, very similar in the way that he uses reflections and stuff. So I think it might just be a passing in time, and I think if I go back into it now, I think I might like them. I liked Stalker. That's the other one I thought was pretty good.
I did not like it the first time around. I'll tell you that much.
It was my first one. It was my first one. I think I watched it with my dad. Yeah. Mm. I watched it with my dad, and it's one of his favourite films. And I always feel like if you're watching a film with someone and it's like one of their favourites and they just love it, you'll kind of have a certain likeness towards it anyway, more than you usually would. I think that was kind of why. I think if I'd have watched Stalker as the first one, otherwise I would have probably hated it realistically. But yeah, that's kind of it, I think. Oh, Black Klansman as well, Spike Lee's.
Yeah, I like that movie.
That was really, really good. Yeah, really, really good. Yeah, so that's about it, I think.
Nice. You've been crushing a lot of good stuff.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, but perfect. Okay, well then, now is a good time as ever to get started with Bergman. So I'll start and then we can go back and forth, yeah?
Of course, that's fine.
My first pick is going to be 1951's Summer Interlude. Now, this is Bergman's 10th feature film, which may not seem like a starting point. But if you think about it in terms of when he started, like we said, his first film was in 1946. So that's only 5 years. And it's crazy to think that he was releasing films this quickly. Like,
because that stayed consistent up until like the 70s, obviously, where he started to teach off and do other works. Obviously, in the 70s, I think he started to get into, you know, playwriting and a little bit of stuff like that, and writing a little bit more. But throughout the 60s and 50s and 40s, he was doing like so many films.
How? I know. It's crazy.
I don't know. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And the reason I picked this was with the early 50s, I think that that's when people were finally starting to hear and get to know about him. And Summer Interlude was kind of that turning point. Initially, I was torn between Summer Interlude and Summer with Monica from 1953.
I thought it might be one of them, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm going to pick that one as an honorable mention. I think that Summer with Monica is a lot more cruel. Summer Interlude is a lot more sweet and it has that nice ending. So for me, at least, have you seen both?
So, well, gonna be honest, I haven't actually seen Summer Interlude.
Oh, Anna, yeah.
Crazy. So, I have seen Summer with Monica. I figured you kind of you would have picked one or the other. I think that's like kind of a period in his career. Summer with Monica is an interesting one as well because it's very, I mean, it's philosophical and reflective, such as any Bergman, but it's a lot more accessible for a general audience person. But I don't know, like. I do need to watch Summer Interlude, actually, because that one does really speak to me in terms of what I've read about it and what you've said about it. Summer with Monica I like. I wasn't, like, huge on by any means, but, I think it's a good watch nonetheless.
I guess I'll explain Summer Interlude to you and to everybody else, but especially you if you haven't seen it. So it's about a ballerina, Marie, and she is reminiscing about her very first love when she has suddenly sent his diary randomly. So then we watch flashbacks of their summer romance on an island. It's super beautiful. Yeah. And when she returns to the island in the present day to like reminisce farther, it's autumn. And so Bergman cleverly uses the symbolism of death to show how everything is decaying around her in nature, which is mirroring how she feels. So, and then you see the contrast in the past, you know, how he always has wild strawberries in the summer, blah, blah, blah. All of that is gone. So I picked this because, like I said, it feels like a turning point for Bergman, but it's also when he starts touching on those themes that would define his career. So those of isolation, characters who can't escape their past or they're, you know, unable to forget it. It was also a very personal film for him as well. Did you know that?
I didn't know because I've not actually read much about it. Prior, I think I spoke to you about it briefly, but I don't actually know that much about it in general. To be
about
honest,
it.
I didn't actually know it was a personal film.
So the reason why he did it was because he himself had his own sort of swirling romance in the summer at his summer home, his parents' summer home. And she eventually got polio and she passed away. So in the 1930s, when he was 18, he actually wrote a short story about her. And then in 1949... he made this. And it ended up being the movie that, although he didn't consider the best, it was the movie that he was most fond of because it was the first time that he was able to explore this.
I do remember this. Actually, I think we spoke about it. I think it was you because obviously I know you were a big fan of it, about his fondness for the film. Like him, you know, not saying directly it was his best film or his best ever work, but kind of the one he was most fond of just because of that reflective nature and, you know, the memories that came with it and stuff like that.
So yeah, I think that's beautiful. But for you, what's your first pick then?
So I kind of struggle, to be honest, because I think that, like I said, his earlier career, there's nothing that I love. And I wanted to pick things that I love because I think I wanted to pick things that really resonate with me. So obviously there was a few films that, you know, that I could have chosen. One from like the 50s that I recently watched, a few months ago, was The Magician. I don't know if you've seen that. That I liked a lot, but again, it wasn't something that kind of really struck me. I think a lot of his early works are similar. Like I've seen Crisis, Dreams, for example. But the first one that kind of sticks with me, one that I hold, you know, really highly, is 1961's Through a Glass Darkly, which is kind of the primary one. So it's an interesting one because I think the reason that it resonates with me so much is kind of someone who's dealt with similar issues just in life in general that Harriet Anderson's obviously character has, just with, you know, issues with psychosis, issues with isolation, abandonment and stuff. And I think that this is kind of where Bergman just, especially for that time, it was such kind of like a brave move to explore a lot of the notions that he did, especially with mental health and stuff that isn't, you know, really covered. And I think the perfect thing about this film is Harry Anderson's incredible performance, but his Bergman's ability to kind of allow her to showcase what it is actually like for people who have similar mental illnesses. And I think that's an issue with a lot of modern films as well, is that usually one doesn't come out without the other. So for example, I'd reflected to like a Melancholia, like Lars von Trier's Melancholia, yep, with Kirsten Dunst. For me, that's like where you've got Kirsten Dunst, who's an amazing performer, but I don't know if Lars managed to completely reflect how the actual feelings are within the screenplay itself. And I think Bergman just manages to move those just concurrently together just so nicely. I also think just the setting, you know, the themes of isolation, being on this isolated kind of area, you know, with the beach, kind of the boat house and the kind of dark and damp house that obviously the family's staying in. You've got obviously the her brother just going through, you know, his issues with sexuality, sexual repression. And then obviously you've got the dad going through his issues at the side, who's played by Gunnar Bjornstrand, who's just one of, you know, Bergman's best ever collaborators, just an incredible performer. And I just think every shot manages to elicit powerful themes. Obviously Sven Nykvist, I think that's how you pronounce it. I can't remember how you pronounce his name. He's obviously on this, and you know, we've spoken about him before. I think that he manages to really elevate any Bergman project. And I think that this is kind of, for me, this is not only kind of one of his most underappreciated films, one of his best. Like I hold it, you know, really, really highly, purely for how I resonate with it on kind of a mental and emotional level as well. And how much I appreciate, you know, how brave he was willing to go, you know, in that period of time. So yeah, that is my first pick. Have you seen it? I think
yes,
you've seen it.
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
I just rewatched it recently. I'm surprised you didn't go with The Magician for your first pick, although you didn't give me your honorable mention, so.
That is my honorable mention.
Oh, well, there
I
you think. Go.
The Magician is like kind of, so it's like, I tried to look at late 50s and there's just not that much that's like kind of calling to me. The two that I thought the most were Wild Strawberries and The Magician, both of them being Wild Strawberries especially. I think Wild Strawberries is one that you can kind of, is more, one another one that's quite accessible for a general audience. It's one that I recommend a lot, just because it's just, you know, it's a simple thing about, you know, about aging, about reflecting about life and enjoying it and doing something about it. And I think, I just don't love those. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to pick ones that I like, love.
You adored.
The first one I do in his filmography is Through a Glass Darkly. But I'll say that the honorable mention I would probably go for is Wild Strawberries, being around that kind of era, like 2 years, 3 years apart or whatever.
That's interesting. Actually, this is a perfect segue to my next one. For my next pick, this was hard. Especially because, like you said, there's so many fantastic films from him, from like the late 50s to the 60s. So I was torn. So interestingly, the first two movies of his that I watched were these two. So I have a personal attachment. So my second pick is going to be The Seventh Seal. And the honorable mention is going to be Wild Strawberries. And okay, which one do you prefer? I'm assuming you prefer Seventh Seal, right?
Yeah, I probably do. I think the spiritual nature of Seventh Seal, that was the first Bergman I ever watched, which is probably not what I'd recommend for a first Bergman.
No, same.
In general.
Yeah.
No, not at all. I don't know why. I think it was like, I believe
the imagery.
Seventh Seal is obviously one of, exactly, yeah. It's probably one of his most known works, I would say, if not maybe his most known, maybe ever, along with probably Persona, probably the main one. And I think spiritually, I think it just kind of, the themes kind of, I like and I absorb them a little bit easier. So I'd probably prefer, Seventh Seal would be higher in my like ranks or whatever.
Yeah. So I never actually sat down to compare these two, but then as I was prepping this episode, it struck me that they're actually thematically similar, or they carry similarities, because of course Wild Strawberries is a lot less allegorical. It's also personal to Bergman, as you know, but they're both films that tell the stories of our lead's final journeys, if you think about it in that sense. So they're both reflective, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So we see that these characters, in both movies, they ventured far away from home. So I never actually sat down to compare these two. But as I was prepping the episode, I realized that they're thematically similar. Wild Strawberries is a lot less allegorical and it's a lot more personal to Bergman. But they're both films that tell, I guess, the story of the final journeys of our leads. So they're characters that have ventured far away from home, and they're now returning to these places that are dear to them. And to Bergman, this really represented a return that harks back to remembering something essential or special in our lives that we as adults have lost along the way. So it's kind of like a rebirth or a finding oneself in adulthood. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting. Like, it is really the final journey that the characters like face in the films. Mm-hmm. I never actually compared them. You know, you never actually think about comparison because, again, as I said before, I think that the accessibility of both is so different. You know, you'd recommend Wild Strawberries, you wouldn't really recommend Seventh Seal, but then thematically they are similar. You've just got Seventh Seal, which has got, you know, a lot more religious and spiritual allegories. You know, Wild Strawberries has its own notions, but it's mainly about this man's passage, you know, a very personal passage we spoke about before. But yeah, they're definitely, yeah, 100% thematically similar. I would never think to compare them. Do you know what I mean? It's not... in my head to compare them.
Yeah, definitely. Until I was doing research for this, and then I was like, whoa, oh my God. But to explain The Seventh Seal, I guess, to listeners who haven't seen it, although I feel like if you're listening to this podcast about Bergman specifically, you've probably seen The Seventh Seal. But anyway, so it's following a medieval knight, Antonius Bloch, who is returning home from the Crusades to find Sweden devastated by the plague. So he quite literally comes across Death, who takes the form of like a hooded figure cloaked in black. And Antonius challenges him to a game of chess for his life. And as he's traveling home, he keeps playing chess with Death, trying to prolong his life, essentially. And then he meets other people along the way. And above all, this journey is defined by his own thoughts that God doesn't exist.
It's really that's one that I haven't actually rewatched in a while, but it's a really, really interesting way that he wrote that. I think just with the chess and Death and the reflection, I think some of the imagery in Seventh Seal specifically is some of the best ever in any Bergman film, especially by the side of the sea when they're playing the chess. That's obviously why it comes, you know, why it's so renowned in his filmography amongst others. It's one that I definitely need to revisit. I think I'd probably like it. I've only seen that one once, Seventh Seal, probably about a year ago now, or just under. I think I need to revisit that one because I think with where my taste is at now, I probably would prefer that now, like go a little bit higher in my filmography. But I definitely think it's got some of the most interesting visuals in a Bergman film, which is pretty hard to do because like all of them have something interesting visually speaking, you know what I mean? But yeah. Yeah, 100%. I really like both, but I think I'd prefer slightly Seventh Seal over two.
Yeah. I was actually surprised when I rewatched it last night how much comedy is actually in it, too. Like, I was laughing a lot throughout this.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Which
surprisingly
is weird.
So.
Yeah,
given
for something that's
given
dark.
The themes.
Exactly.
Absolutely. It's kind of the case, like, in a lot of, obviously, Bergman's, probably all the ones we'll speak about today, in that he does provide some sort of unique wit. That I think some of them take another watch to kind of get that aspect as well. Especially in some of the more family orientated and family-related ones. But yeah, 100%, 100%. I need to rewatch it, definitely.
Also just the concept of using chess, which is what Antonius is obviously doing, he's playing chess, to prolong his own life. Because in essence, and this came to me last night too, in essence, in a game of chess, you're playing against someone, and if they happen to make better moves, if they're stronger than you, what you as a player are doing is prolonging your own life or that of your king. So,
yeah,
right? That's kind
of
weird.
Yeah, I love that.
Also, did you know that his father was a Christian or a parish minister?
I did, because I think that was in... I can't remember what he watched. I watched... it's either an interview of his or a rough documentary. It was on YouTube. It was when I was first getting into him. And I did know that. I just think we've actually had a brief conversation about it before, but it is really interesting because then you go back to his work and you're like, oh.
These themes
kinda make
sense.
Yeah. It's like sometimes when I look back at Scorsese's as well, for example, it's a similar thing with obviously his background and kind of the imagery he puts in there. It kind of all starts to make sense as to why there's such a... Why so many of his films surround spirituality in general or anything of that nature.
I guess to summarize it before I let you go, I think what I love about this the most is that theme of death could not hold the power that it has if life wasn't worth living. So as we live, we escape death. And perhaps when we're faced with death or when our future is about to be erased, that's when we're given a chance to look honestly and thoroughly at ourselves and objectively.
My next one is going to be my favorite, but I did want to give an honorable mention with this one, another Liv Ullmann featuring one, and that's my honorable mention would be Hour of the Wolf.
Nice.
And I do think that kind of relates to the film I'm going to give, and that's Persona. Just in kind of the way that it really emphasizes the kind of surrealist nature. I think we've mentioned this before. I know some people got a bit annoyed at you about this, but the kind of Lynchian aspects, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But it very much is. It's like people, Hour of the Wolf and Persona have very similar qualities with the camera work and how they present thematics, but in this kind of surrealist nature way that loads of directors have taken from, of course. Which is just funny how you got, yeah, it's great. Lynchian, it's in the dictionary. But yeah, like I think that Hour of the Wolf is really interesting. It's like one, you know, Bergman's one and only horror film, you know, that has these, you know, thematic similarities to Seventh Seal and Persona, especially with it going to spirituality. But it has this like strikingly contemporary, like folk horror vibe, you know, very similar to like a modern one that you get with like The Witch, etc., or The Lighthouse specifically. I mean, mm-hmm. Lighthouse is, you know, obvious Persona yeah. and an Hour of the Wolf inspiration there or inspired. My chosen one is Persona, which is my favorite Bergman, as cliche as it seems, I guess. Just a fantastic film with so much to it, just in terms of identity, in terms of finding yourself as well, and having, you know, obviously you've got the two characters, you've got Alma, who's like the one who's portrayed, you know, within society. And kind of the other one who's portrayed with art, I can't remember the name now, thinking about it. What is the other name? Alma and...
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, that's the one, yeah. And you're the inner and outer self, and kind of where she wants to go with her life, which is kind of mapped around by this, you know, very visceral imagery, beautiful selections of dialogue from, obviously, B.B. Anderson. And it's amazing how Liv Ullmann, like, completely is like a powerhouse in this film, but yet barely says anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just her use of facial expression, which again is kind of what Bergman gets the most out with his actors, and what Sven as a cinematographer specifically in this one, because some of the shots in this are just incredibly, incredibly surreal, because it does have a surrealist nature, but it's incredibly grounded with what it's trying to talk about, you know, finding yourself and finding true self in terms of society as well. So this is my number one Bergman, like, ever. And I think that the instances of, like, long monologues are some of my favourite sequences ever as well, specifically B.B. Anderson's when they kind of first go into the house. And I think that the scenes at the start are so interesting. Obviously, the scene when she's kind of nursing, because, again, that's her, like, inner self talking, you know, what she wants to do with, obviously, the actress and stuff like that. And this was actually the second Bergman I ever watched. And after I watched it, and I watched so many other films from today, I think this is the one that has the most clear and obvious influence on general, not just surreal films, but anything to do with, you know, identity or life, or even sexuality to a certain extent, which is again something that Bergman tackled in an era which wasn't as kind to that. And I think that there is so much going on with Persona that it makes it so I've seen Persona about three times now, I think, and even now there's things I still don't get. Do you know what I mean? It's one that you really have to watch over and over again, which I think is just so enjoyable. And I also think it's so impressive how Bergman was able to capture so much in such a small time frame.
Totally.
Like, most of his films are like 80 to 90 minutes, that kind of mark, mm-hmm. unless you get to like the Fanny Alexander Season of Marriage, which we'll go over. But most of his films is kind of talk around the area, and he's able to pack so much in. You know, so you've got identity, you've got sexuality, you've got religion, you've got, you know, your subconscious and kind of tackling with it. But yeah, so Persona's my pick. My honourable mention would probably go to Hour of the Wolf, because I do think they're kind of similar in a way, thematically, as well as visually speaking. I know that you're a big fan of Persona as well, I'm assuming, anyway.
That was going to be my next pick, actually, from 1966. I'm actually surprised that your honorable mention was Hour of the Wolf, because I thought it would be the same one as mine, which is 1968's Shame.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. That might be my next pick in general.
Okay. Well, I'm going to... We've screwed each other over.
Hear me out. Because he's so dissimilar to the rest of his filmography, and so I do see it like a different time frame in a way, even though it's 2 years apart. But I think that the reason I chose The Hour of the Wolf is because with it being his one and only horror, and it's so reminiscent of one we were just speaking about with Seventh Seal thematically, and Persona, it's very reflective, very the same in nature. And I don't feel like people speak about Hour of the Wolf like a lot, like compared to Persona or Seventh Seal or something like that. But it is like it's one that I imagine a lot of people would be able to have a pretty good time with as well.
Just it's his only horror too, right?
Of course, yeah. I think he only did that and like one thriller. Have you seen his side note? Have you seen his like early thriller, by the way? His like crime noir. It's called This Can't Happen Here. Heard of it?
No, I've never even heard
like
of
it. It was like a thriller noir mystery. It was like a studio one that he did. It's terrible. It's so bad. It was from 1950.
Yeah.
And there are literal interviews and talks with Bergman where you can find about him saying how much he hated this film. He tried to bury it. Like Fincher's Alien 3 or Lynch's Dune.
Yeah.
Of course. And that is like his one. But luckily, it only has 1,000 logs on Letterboxd. And I once saw it on YouTube. I was like, oh, Bergman Mystery. This could be cool.
Yeah.
It was like, it's atrocious. Really
well,
bad.
Now I need to watch it, even if it's bad. I'm so curious.
Just to watch a bad Bergman film. They don't come around just very often. Do you know what I mean? That's the thing.
Probably one or two.
Yeah, I should have chosen that, shouldn't I? That would have been interesting.
Yeah, you should have. But we can come back on for another episode of Worst Bergman Movies. It'll probably be like 15 minutes.
One film. One
yeah, exactly. Film. So it's interesting how we're categorizing our picks by the years, because if you ask a film historian, they say that the second part of his career lasts from the mid to late 1960s until the mid 1980s. That is considered a second chunk, which I find kind of weird because that seems to be really long. To go back to what we were talking about originally, which is Persona is my pick. I mean, you said everything that I was going to say, much like The Seventh Seal. I feel like this is the film that cinephiles are most aware of when it comes to its iconic imagery. It's also a film that's difficult to discuss because it's so open to interpretations. Like, I've read numerous times actually that both critics and scholars struggle to explain it, like out of any other movie, which makes me feel a bit better about myself.
Same here. It's one that it's very similar to like how I would describe, obviously not to compare again, but like a Lynch project, in that there are so much you can take from it, and the kind of point is, you know, not to get it as such, as to make your own interpretations. And I think that's similarly with Lynch did with Eraserhead. I'm choosing this comparison because it was, you know, straight after whatever. It really is just a thing where it's a kind of a film you have to experience and you have to feel, and with the conversations that they're having, you will just inevitably draw your own conclusions and your own theories. I've spoken to most people who think, you know, differently than I do, but it's one that you're always going to get. That it's just divisive opinions. It's one. Persona's like a really good one to speak about in general. I mean, they're all great to speak about because it's Bergman, but particularly this one because it is so surreal in nature, or at least more than, you know, other works of his.
Totally. Yeah. So he did you know that he wrote this when he was in the hospital? He was like sick, feverish. And that's when he wrote this, in like the time span. I can't remember how many weeks it was, but it didn't take him that long. But he got the idea to do this after he came across Liv Ullmann in a Danish-Norwegian co-production. I think it was called Short is the Summer. That's what it was called. And he was struck at how much she looked like B.B. Anderson. And he claimed that Persona literally saved his life. Like, no exaggeration. He said, "If I had not found the strength to make that film, I would have probably been washed up. One significant point is, for the first time, I did not care in the least whether the result would be a commercial success," which is, to your point, it's so abstract of a movie. And along with Cries and Whispers, he felt that Persona was the moment that he had creatively gone as far as he could go with total freedom and just zero constraints.
It's interesting that he says that about this. What was the film he made prior to Persona? I'm trying to... Was it maybe Silence?
Maybe. I watched Silence. Even. Yeah. I loved that movie. What did you think?
I really, really like that. I think that's a really, really interesting film. Very much lesser seen in his filmography as well. Very similar to, like, thematically to Shame, I would argue, as well. But yeah, I really liked Silence. I watched it like a while back, actually. It's one of the first, like, kind of 5 or 10 I watched, actually. But it's interesting because obviously he did, I think it was Silence, but knowing Bergman, he probably did like five films in between Silence and
Silence was from 19, was 3 years before Persona. So there
okay,
must
so he
be,
probably did something.
Yeah,
20. He probably was something else. I'm intrigued because obviously like what he would have done prior to that with that kind of mentality is the main thing. Commercial success, obviously something I've read about, he spoke about it many times where he just stopped kind of caring regarding that and just wanted to express himself as an artist creatively, which is, you know, the best way we can be. But I'm just intrigued as to what kind of film he made prior. He did Winter Light in the same year as Silence.
Yeah,
which
that's
crazy.
I didn't really like Winter Light personally. I got to revisit it.
It's lowered, much lower down on my ratings than most. Because that's actually, which is weird because like First Reformed is like literally Winter Light.
Same film.
I'm obsessed with First Reformed to the point where it's one of my favorite films ever. And yeah, I watched Winter Light and I'm like, I didn't really like it. Well, I liked it, but I didn't really love it. Which is wild because it is First Reformed. Like it's
a prototype. Yeah. Like you were saying, Sven Nykvist is also incredible. And just those timeless images of like both of their faces superimposed. It's phenomenal. And I was actually reading an interview with Bergman where he showed both of them the final result of their faces together. And Anderson was like, oh, that's a terrible picture of you, Liv. And Liv was like, no, that's not me. That's you.
I love that so much. I think it's like, it's similarly with what I was saying about like Poor Things, where you can literally pause this at any moment and you'll have like shots of the century. There are some moments in this, obviously I'll bring it up because people do, but the mirror scene specifically, in really looking at the reflections of their identity and understanding what the differences is between the two characters, between the subconscious and the outer conscious, I think that's such a power. Probably, like I think I mentioned this to you, actually, if I was to get another tattoo, film-related one, I want that, you know, that image of like just those in the mirror, and I think that... Yeah, I think that's one of the most kind of powerful scenes, at least one of my favorite scenes probably ever, purely for how it meshes with the themes of the film, definitely.
It's those themes of personal identity and duality. I mean, it makes sense. I read that Bergman was reading a lot of Jung at the time as well, so there's just definite influence there. You should come back for an episode just on Persona, because I feel like we could talk about this for hours.
A full Bergman ranking of like 80 films.
To just take some into your day.
How many has he done? I want to say it's like 48, maybe?
Yeah, somewhere there. Like I mean, Letterboxd says 70, but then there's repeats.
Like loads of
There's like the televised version, but then it counts the theatrical as another one, et cetera, et cetera.
I think there's like, on Letterboxd as well, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of films that, like documentary-style films that say directed by or something like that because it shows footage that he filmed. So I think it might be like 40 to 50, but I'll be honest, some of the early ones I've seen, I don't care about anyway. But they're the easiest to find on YouTube. That's the issue, you know, for free and stuff. That's the problem. I did actually just check. So the film he did before Persona, Now It Makes Sense, was a film which is actually one of his lowest regarded films ever. It's called All These Women. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of it. I haven't seen it, though. Have you?
No, I haven't, actually. And I've spoken to someone about it before. I believe it had... Yeah, so it had, like, a really good cast. It had Harriet Anderson, B.B. Anderson, like, kind of the usual people you usually see. I believe it was, like, a comedy or pitched as a comedy originally. But it's very kind of shallow and not really much to it, which is crazy from Bergman, from people I've seen anyway. And it was, like, a flat-out, like... Not like a genuine comedy, and that was kind of what it was pitched as on the marketing front as well. So I think that kind of makes sense now if that was in the middle of the two. And then before, after Magician, which was in 63, he also made another film, which, interestingly enough, was also one that didn't actually do that well from a critical standpoint, which was called... A Dream Play, which I believe was like one of his televised plays.
Which
I don't believe did that well. So I think it kind of makes sense why creatively he was like in this bankrupt where he was working with the studios, kind of doing things to get these financial. I imagine that's probably why he did a comedy, for example, a stage show. And then he's got onto that and he's realized, you know, I've not really been my creative head hasn't been in place for this whole time, so I think that's probably why. And it kind of makes sense now, do you know, when you look at it and you look at the releases and stuff.
Wow, this is an insightful episode even for me. Jeez, I had no idea about that. That's really cool. And then, yeah, for my honorable mention, I went with Shame, which I think you actually got me to watch, so thank you.
So good.
But I think it's one of my favorite war movies, because it shows, you know, a breakdown of society, as many war movies do, but it also on a micro scale, you see the breakdown of a marriage and how war affects individuals, how their moral compasses shift, the guilt, and quite literally the shame. I love it. I also think it's, weirdly enough, one of his most accessible movies in terms of it's not that abstract.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, like, Shame's an interesting one. It's very, that is my pick, by the way, so apologies. I know I've got 2 years, you know, between, but...
Yeah.
Shame is a really interesting film. I know, crazy. So mine is Shame, believe it or not. It is quite accessible because it's you know, a war film. But I think what's most impressive about it is that Bergman uses, you know, we've seen a lot of war films where it shows down the breakdown of society, breakdown of families, whatever. But he uses the war as merely kind of a backdrop, as a background to... And shows the consequences of war on just two people, on just two, a marriage... the intimacy between them, how their relationship kind of crumbles as the war is happening. And it's just like heartbreaking and really sorrowful, and probably one of his most visceral films from an imagery standpoint as well. Just like kind of forceful thematically, in your face almost, which isn't Bergman's usual standpoint, but I think it really hits you over the head with it as well, which again, I think what Bergman excelled in his career was subtlety with his themes and getting across something where you have... you know, room to interpret different analysis. But this one, it is accessible. Like you said, it's almost like, it's similar to like a Wild Strawberries, where you know exactly where it's going, but you can't help just be in awe at the style. But I think, yeah, what's most impressive about it, because it is a war film, but it's merely, you know, the war's a backdrop. It's completely a backdrop, and it really showcases what can happen to individuals and to people. And we see in most war films now where it's like, okay, you know, groups, society's going down, they're losing money, whatever it might be. But this is two people, and that's it. Or well, obviously people they meet as well, but primarily in the film, it's just those two. And I think that's, you know, a really, really strong reflection. And obviously it's Liv Ullmann again, who's just like
amazing,
the shining star of like any Bergman
everything.
Film. Side note: have you seen The Passion of Anna as well, which is kind of in the unofficial trilogy with?
So Shane, not yet. That's one that I can't believe I haven't seen yet. It's definitely one I'm going to watch. Yeah.
Honorable mention.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that your honorable mention?
I was kind of stuck between two. Yeah, it could work. I think that Passion of Anna is really interesting because it's kind of similar in that it's kind of follows, I can't remember the actor's name now, Max von...
von Sydow?
Sydow, Sydow. And then it's a man, you know, suffering and kind of built up a defensive like facade and built up like defensive techniques, and it really goes into his marriage and kind of the demise of that, and Liv Ullmann there as well. It's been a while since I watched that one. I think it's part of a unofficial trilogy with another film.
Yeah.
I can't, because obviously Bergman had two like trilogies. He had obviously the Faith trilogy, I think it is, which is Silence, Through a Glass Darkly, and Winter Light. And there's another one, but I can't actually remember what it is. But The Passion of Anna is a really, really interesting film. I haven't seen it in a while, but I definitely think you'd really like it from what I remember, in that it kind of is similar thematically to A Shame in the way that it works with marriage, but you're following a guy whose marriage has recently kind of had this demise, had this fall through, and of his built-up emotions from that and how he copes with them. Really, really interesting film. But yeah, so Shame is definitely my pick. I know I kind of cheated, which is, you know, whatever.
Whatever.
But I did figure the reason I chose Shame is just because it's just different to, I think, many of his other films. It's bold, like most of them. It's visually incredible, like most of them. But it kind of has these themes that are right thrown in your face that works. You know what I mean? I think it's accessible, like you said, but just a different style of Bergman than you're used to seeing. Not visually or character-y, whatever. But just thematically, I think it's there. Like similar, you said, it's very much one of my favorite war films. I actually rewatched Shame today, before I went to see Poor Things earlier. There are some shots in it that are just kind of striking when it really uses it as a backdrop, when they're in the house, when they're outside, when like they're doing daily tasks. And not to give it a direct comparison, but I don't know if you've seen The Ascent from 1977. It's a Soviet war film directed by Larissa Shevchenko. I can't remember her name.
Yeah. She's the wife of Alim Klimov. No, or she was, I think.
Who directed Come and See.
Come and See. But no, I don't think I've seen that. That's on my list.
So it's kind of similar to that, what I'd compare it with, in that it shows the reflections of war from an individual standpoint. And there's a lot of like shots of just, so in The Ascent, it's two soldiers, in this, it's a married couple, but the soldiers aren't, they're just doing, you know, day-to-day tasks, doing daily errands, as Liv Ullmann does in obviously Shame, and it shows the demise of that and the fall from that in their relationships, which I think is really, really interesting. So if anyone's listening, definitely watch The Ascent as well. It's one that I'd 100% recommend, because it's more of an intimate war film. It's not like a, you know, the one we used to seeing and the ones people speak about a lot. Because I think when people say war films, it's very much, you know, here's epic battles.
Yes.
There's kind of a lot more in the genre that's kind of not, you know, lesser spoken about, because it really doesn't, like, for example, you could even include like things like The Cremator, for example.
Yeah.
Because
totally.
It has the thematics there, and you know, that's really because of the collapse of the war and the collapse of the country at that time in Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia. And I think that people need to concentrate on that area of war films a little bit more, just because they're so interesting. People kind of neglect them a lot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't tend to exist now. I can't remember the last like war film that was. Do you know what I mean? I actually can't remember the last war film that came out that was like this, because they're all now built to make money and whatever. But yeah, I just think Shame is a really interesting film in Bergman's career, just because it's different. It's similar, but it's also different in the way that it reflects his themes.
Did you have an honorable mention for this or no?
I'll go with The Passion of Anna, because I think it's
similar
thematically. I think that'll be like my favorite film.
That's good. It's interesting how we decided, I said it earlier, how we decided to group these. Because for me, my next one, I'm now into the 1970s of his career. So, yeah, what were you going to say?
I left one just for you. There's like two films in the 70s that I love. I deliberately left one for you. And I'm thinking in my head, I'll take this one because I feel like Marta will take this one.
So yeah, like, I did that too.
Your job now is to pick the right one so I can choose.
Yeah.
I've actually wrote notes. Because I've wrote notes about one, but I haven't done it about the other one.
Let's see. Yeah, it's a gamble. So I'm a huge fan of Scenes from a Marriage, as you know, Cries and Whispers.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
And Autumn Sonata.
Of course.
It was, of course. But I decided to be kind to you, and I'm going to go with 1974 Scenes from a Marriage with my honorable mention in Autumn Sonata.
Perfect. Yeah, that's fine.
And I'm very sad to let Cries and Whispers go, because it's just, I think, one of his most visually stunning movies. Like, have you seen Cries and Whispers?
That might be my pick.
Okay, then I'm not going to say more. I'm going to go back to Scenes from a Marriage, which is quite literally the scenes from a marriage of a couple, Marianne, and I think his name is Johan, and they're played by Liv Ullmann and Erland Josephson, also phenomenal. I adore him. We see their marriage. It's how it's starting off with bliss and ease, and then it leads to crisis and despair, and then ultimately catharsis. Initially, this was televised on Swedish television as a miniseries divided into, I believe, 6 parts. I've said this before online, but I really do think that the televised version is the way to go instead of the theatrical cut, because the emotional punches that Bergman delivers to your like very soul have so much more impact once you get to know the characters better and once you spend more time with them. What really struck a chord with me thematically here was that it deals with the understanding of love and the acceptance of others without demanding that they change. So this could be romantic. This could also be familial or platonic. There's even a point where Marianne even says that she's never been allowed to discover who she is before her marriage, because her home life with her parents consisted of their demands and their expectations. And as cruel as the movie is, Bergman does leave room for reconciliation. And even more importantly, just healing between these two individuals, which, I guess it ends on a happy note. Surprising, considering what happens.
Yeah, of course.
Liv Ullmann called Erland Josephson her best friend in real life. And she basically said that it's because they're best friends that they can bear their souls to one another on camera and deliver these incredible performances. And I think Scenes from a Marriage is a phenomenal example of that. Have you seen it? No, right?
So I know a lot about it from someone who kind of spoiled it for me, essentially. but I haven't actually seen it. I actually own it, which is quite bad of me. So time is not on my side. It's not been on my side recently. I actually planned to watch it last week. So I own the televised cut, which is obviously the preferred version. Obviously, Bergman said it himself. And it makes sense. I think it's similar to a film we're guaranteed to go over, right? I assume, next decade, obviously. Which, obviously, we can do, you know, comparisons as well. But, yeah, I really do need to watch this one because I think both of them are probably two of my favourite actors from that kind of period from Bergman's era. I think it really, from what I've heard about it, I think it'd be one that I love as well, probably, just in terms of what it showcased. But yeah, so I do own it, so I definitely need to watch it 100%.
I didn't spoil it for you, I promise.
I think someone else has spoiled it for me. I've spoke to someone about this before, and I think I know what happens.
Oh.
You know the thing you're speaking about? You know?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, I'm not going to say it, but I think I know what that is. But maybe. I don't want to say it, because then you'll just be like... Maybe, yeah. You know?
exactly.
I think I know what that is. Yeah.
Maybe,
but I do want to watch it, definitely.
You should. It's amazing. The result is a story that's honestly just so realistic that it said that after the televised version aired in Sweden, divorce rates spiked in Sweden because people were treating it like a documentary.
Of course, yeah.
But yeah, that's my pick.
Did you have an honorable mention for that?
But it was Autumn Sonata. Were you going to include that for yours, or should I say
that's going to be mine as well? That's going to be mine as well. Honorable mention, I mean.
Yeah, I think it's just a movie that resonated with me. I'm sure it resonates with so many people who've had, you know, like a tumultuous relationship with their parent or parents. It's just such an unflinching look at family dynamics. It can be bitter at times, and it can be really hard to stomach too, but... yeah, just watching Liv Ullmann verbally spar with her mother in this, who's played by Ingrid Bergman, it's just, you see decades upon decades of shimmering emotions that are put on display in like the most cathartic way, in my opinion. So that's all I'm going to say about Autumn Sonata.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's one of his kind of most emotionally raw films. Just turns that familial dynamic between Ingrid Bergman and Liv Ullmann. And again, broken record, but Liv Ullmann, I mean... Ingmar Bergman's also amazing, but Liv Ullmann, this specifically, is just, like, otherworldly. I probably consider this to be one of my favourite performances ever, because I think it really comes across her raw emotion, her devastation with, obviously, her relationship with her mom. And again, I think it's one that people can easily resonate with, you know, much like a lot of Bergman stuff, which is very hard to do. I do recommend Autumn Sonata a lot when people ask me, you know, what maybe they should watch for the first one, because not only is it accessible, it's also one of his best, you know, in my humble opinion. And I think that a lot of people can resonate with it if they've had, you know, issues with not just parents, but just familial issues, friendship issues, whatever it might be, and loss and reconnection. I think it's gut-wrenching, it's unflinching, it's just they go to just a verbal battle the entire time, and it's a really interesting way he presents it as well. But yeah, that would be my honorable mention, because I think that's was that his... So did he do one between that and Fanny Alexander?
That was, I think, Autumn Sonata. I should have written this down. That was in 1974. Oh, I thought it was 74. No, you're right.
I'm pretty sure it was 78. Okay.
Yeah. And what were you saying? The other one was Fanny Alexander. That was in 82. So
82. Okay. So he did documentary. That was the Pharaoh documentary. So From the Life of Marie Antoinette. Is that, I don't actually know what that is. Oh, that was a TV movie.
Oh, okay. Which he did many of later on.
Have you seen any of his TV movies?
No. I mean, I've seen televised versions of, like, Fanny and Alexander and Scenes from a Marriage. Yeah, but that's it.
After the Rehearsal, which was just after Fanny and Alexander in 84, that had Erland Josephson in. Very... meh, I'll be honest. Like, I didn't have a great time with it. I've seen a couple of his TV movies, and they're a bit... whatever.
Did he use Sven Nykvist for the TV movies, or no?
I don't think he did in the one that I'm speaking about specifically. I'm just going to double-check that now.
Because he did it.
Oh, he did. No, he did. For some reason, I had in my head that... well, Fanny Alexander, obviously, was his last project with them. So maybe he did use him for the majority of his TV movies, actually, as well. Which kind of makes sense, looking back at it, but... for some reason, I don't remember that he didn't. But yeah, he did.
Interesting. So what was your main pick then, if Autumn Sonata is your honourable mention?
So it was Cries and Whispers I figured one of us would either mention Autumn Sonata anyway, because you know, that's known to be one of his strongest films, which I would definitely agree with. I think that Cries and Whispers is maybe his most depressing film, which says a lot, because it's a Bergman, which is ridiculous. But I think the ability he has to showcase, you know, real human pain and grief using purely facial expression in this, just the main actresses in this are just unbelievable. And I think the kind of the most fascinating thing about Cries and Whispers is the use of red and white to represent kind of the life cycle, obviously the passing away, and the use of color in this is just so incredible. And it kind of has this like dreamlike, like fairy tale, like look to it and feel to it, where it really feels like the afterlife almost, and the kind of full of, you know, biblical allegories similar to the rest of his works, but just in a really like raw and depressing way. Like, you're literally watching people just die in front of you. It's really, really sad and hard to handle, whilst also dealing with these, you know, these familial connections and them kind of losing each other in that space. And I think it's, yeah, one of, which is, you know, as I said, it's hard to say. I do believe this is probably the most depressing film, which is ridiculous because they're all depressing. You know, you're not going to get many happy Bergman films. But I think this one really showcased the ability of really structuring a shot and using the colours to tell a story, which obviously we'd see 11 years later even better in Fanny Alexander, which obviously we'll go on to. The use of colour in that is extraordinary. And I also think it's similar in terms of it has that, obviously the use of colour is there, but it has that fairy tale-like approach. It's got that kind of fantasy-like tale to it almost. And I think it really, really comes across. So yeah, Cries and Whispers was definitely my pick. One of his best films. And I figured one of us would speak about, like, there's three main 70s films, isn't there, that everyone speaks about, really. Scene to a Marriage, Autumn Sonata, and Cries and Whispers. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're both really interesting, and we were going to speak about one of them anyway. So
yeah, exactly. I think that's so interesting that you mentioned that Cries and Whispers has that fairy tale quality, and then you related it to Fanny and Alexander, because yes, but I never thought of that. I never would have made that connection. Now you're saying it, and it's just blowing my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense when you think about it, doesn't it? Especially kind of progressively as you move on through his career, I think that was something he started using more. And I think obviously the use of colour comes into that. Was this his first film in colour? No, was it?
I don't think so. Because Autumn Sonata was in 1978, Cries and Whispers was in... Oh, no, Cries and Whispers was in 1972, yeah, or 71.
Oh, 72, sorry.
Maybe.
72. I feel like this was his first film, which if it was, that's that is crazy. An incredible film. Like, a first film in colour, and he's like doing like a Kurosawa's Run. Like, that's not the same comparison.
Whoa.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It was The Passion of Anna. I forgot.
Oh, that was okay.
Second.
And I wouldn't know because I haven't seen it, yeah. But still.
Yeah, yeah, that was his first. Which that's actually, wild. If I remember correctly, does have a good use of colour. But yeah, so this is kind of where I think he maybe wanted to lean kind of more into the fantasy fairy tale, where he had that ability to use these bright imagery, these bright colours. And it's definitely represented, because you watch Cries and Whispers, and one of the main things to point out, obviously they're in these red rooms, red walls, red beds, red chairs, and they're in the white dresses, obviously representing that kind of the flow of life. So I think it really comes across. And I think it does have reminiscent to Fanny Alexander, which obviously we'll go on to. Definitely.
Well, good segue, as you knew that I would go on to that. Yeah. That was
what else would we go on to?
I mean, yeah, so that this is our final pick, right? So, I mean, this was hard to narrow down because you're taking into consideration the 80s, and then in the 90s, he did a bunch of TV movies, like we said, and then his final feature in 2003. So I'm going to go, obviously, with Fanny and Alexander as my final pick from 1982. And then honorable mention, you're going to be surprised, Sarah Band. And the reason I think, I know, I see you going like, oh.
I haven't seen it. Oh, that's true. I don't know much about it.
It wasn't shot by Sven Nykvist. I think that would have made it infinitely better. But the reason I picked it was because my previous pick was Scenes from a Marriage, and Sarah Band's continuation with the same leads after a bunch of time has passed. And I think it's just a beautiful farewell to Bergman as well, because there are so many nods to his previous films. I'm not going to spoil it for you, to his personal life. And it's just touching to me that he ended on a note with two of his dearest collaborators. Like, that's just...
yeah, that's just very Bergman, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely.
But I did things backwards, so I was actually trying to talk about Fanny and Alexander. So yeah, let's do that first. So It's actually interesting now that I'm thinking about it that I picked these two movies because Saraband was his last film, but then he actually intended Fanny and Alexander to be his last film before his retirement. But that's probably his most autobiographical film, wouldn't you say? Do you think? Fanny and Alexander?
From what I know, I would probably say, I think like Fanny and Alexander was built up to be his swan song in a way, his kind of last thing, you know. It's such an epic that it has every element, I would say, of Bergman as a storyteller. Everything he accomplished in his career is showcased in it, to the point where, again, not to compare, but it kind of feels like Hayao Miyazaki just did with The Boy and the Heron.
Yeah.
And then I feel like that was a very reflective personal piece in the most he's done, whereas now we know it was originally going to be his final film, but now we know he's doing other stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has that swan song feel, you know, the last hurrah, the last kind of go at it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a modern comparison I would have. But yeah, definitely, I think...
That's a good comparison.
It is built up like his magnum opus, per se. And I'm sure a lot of people would say that, you know, it is. And it probably is in that sense. So yeah, definitely, 100%.
I think that it's definitely accessible. I think it's one of his most accessible. But I never tell people to do this one first because I think it should be watched after you've seen a few of his other movies.
Like Ram Kurosawa, for example.
Yeah, because you'll be able to spot different themes from his career that all come together here. He said it's so personal to him. So many of the characters are inspired by his childhood. Alexander's kind of like a stand-in to Bergman himself. And much like Scenes from a Marriage, which was initially a longer TV series, there was the same thing with Fanny and Alexander. Have you seen the televised version of Fanny and Alexander yet, or no?
No, so I've only seen it once, and I watched the theatrical because that's all I had access to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because I spoke to you, obviously you've seen the TV, and I spoke to other people who've seen the TV, and there was a reason that Bergman kind of pitched to watch that one. You know, that is the full work, and in something like Fanny Alexander in particular, where it's you have so many different relationships and dynamics within this massive family, you need to kind of get to know the characters well. I mean, admittedly, I still loved it. You know, I still thought it was truly incredible and one of my favourites of his. And I still think that they are fleshed out to his usual standard. But I imagine that emotionally, specifically, especially probably in the final third, where obviously kind of the major plot points happen, I imagine that there's kind of a lot more to it, with obviously the kids specifically being the main thing.
But yeah, so it revolves around Fanny and Alexander, the two children from the Ekdal family. That's what they're called. Very wealthy family. The movie opens on Christmas Eve, and we meet the entire extended family, plus their parents. And after a family tragedy, we see Fanny and Alexander thrust into a situation that gets progressively worse before it gets better. That's all I think I could say without spoiling anything, right?
Yeah, like I think you can't really go into like any of the relationships you know, what happened, especially in that final third, because it really just impacts the whole watch experience. I think especially like spoiling this would be a big one, because like with Persona or whatever, it's like 80 minutes. You're spending like a lot of time with this. How much longer is the TV version in total? I actually don't know the difference. Because the film, I think it's 3:10, 3:20. I feel like the TV is like 4.5 or something, or maybe even more, somewhere around that.
It's 312 minutes for the televised, and the theatrical is 188 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's a bit different. Yeah. Jesus.
It's cleverly split apart with
course,
each episode.
Yeah.
So like I didn't watch it in one sitting. That would be crazy. I mean, I probably could if I had the time, but it doesn't matter, really. You just pick up where you left off the previous day. It's perfect.
It's a limited series, isn't it?
Exactly.
That's kind of how it's pushed.
That's the point. Yeah. I personally love looking at this as Alexander's retelling of his childhood. So it's just filled with imagination and even at times magic, which is even more apparent in the longer version.
I love those scenes. Yeah.
Me too. But then
even in the theatrical, I think that my favorite sequences are this is the... The trick sequence, to be specific, love it.
Yes,
wonderful.
Yes.
And the scene when he's in the, I'm not going to say it, but when he's in the place, it's all weird and surreal. It's almost a horror at certain points. Really has this magical feel. And I think it really is, you know, stressed that it's from the child's point of view where you're seeing the relationships go, where you're seeing the dynamics. it really is, you know, so personal. You're from Bergman's perspective when he was a kid, or, you know, the kid's perspective. And I think it is, like the perfect word for it. Like you said, it's magical in a way. It's like a fairy tale, like, you know, Cries and Whispers, which I spoke about. 100%, yeah, definitely.
But then it also contains so many more somber themes that he's known for as well, like trauma and guilt. And I see Fanny and Alexander not about finding the meaning of your life, but how you choose to live with it and appreciate it above all.
Definitely.
And I think for a movie that he intended to be his final movie, that's a beautiful message.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like it really is, you know, like I was saying before, it really was pitched to be his last swan song, because I think this really has everything that he works on throughout his career in terms of, you know, thematically. You've got themes of religion, obviously there's a lot of biblical allegories, but you've also got themes of in select family members, like sexual repression. You've also got themes of just connection and dealing with loved ones and stuff, because there's so many different characters, so many different dynamics throughout, so many different kind of, you know, mischievous moments and hidden family secrets as well, which are common. I find it interesting as well, because obviously in Sweden, I think this is, you know, still, it's a huge Christmas chronicle that it's like a tradition, you know, as we in the US or the UK would watch, like, It's a Wonderful Life, for example, or Home Alone 2, the best one, of course. But I think that it's like a case where it's such a huge deal. And I actually, on our Discord for Real Talk, there's a few Swedish guys in there, and they always tell me how it's such a big thing to watch it, make sure they watch the televised cut. And I just find it so interesting, because it's like, it's a lot to watch for a Christmas movie every year. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not really one I could, like, chill with necessarily, I don't think. Because there's so much to it. Like, it's one that I really would have to be in that correct mindset for. Do you know what I mean?
So imagine, like, you have your Swedish family, you have your children, the mother and the dad, and you go, yeah, let's watch Fanny and Alexander with these themes,
like,
of a
lot. Like, not like Muppets Christmas Carol. It's,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Let's watch this, like, 5-hour, like, depressing. I mean, it's, you know, it's nice, but, you know, familial, depressing, like, dynamic. But, I mean, you're not going to get much better Christmas movies, are you, realistically?
It's true.
I mean, it's the pinnacle of it. It's the pinnacle of the genre, because it truly is as magnum opus. We haven't even got into, like I said before, the use of colour, the design, the production of this. This is like Bergman's big thing. They went so out, obviously, where they live, the whole house, the rooms, the scenarios, and the colour specifically. It's just done such a remarkable way. And it really was his big... I'm assuming this was his biggest budget film, wasn't it?
I would assume. I also heard that the house, the grandmother's house in the movie, is modeled after Bergman's grandmother's house, and it was also shot in the same town too, which is crazy. That's it for me. What did I go for? I went for Fanny Alexander and Saraband as my honorable mention.
So my pick was Fanny Alexander, obviously.
Obviously,
because, you know, yeah. I don't really have an honorable mention, to be honest with you. Like, I was looking at a few, and, like, within that kind of 70s period, I've not actually watched that many other than, like, the obvious ones we spoke about, you know, Walter Sonata, Cries and Whispers, and one or two others, which I'm not actually that keen on. So I don't actually have one specifically related to this, to be honest. I mean, just to name another Bergman that I really, really like, just to, you know, a couple that we didn't speak about. The Right, I really liked, from 1969. That's a really interesting one. The Brink of Life is pretty good as well. That was one of his early ones. I think that was like mid to late 50s. That's kind of about it. I'm pretty sure we covered everything that I like a lot. Do you know what I mean?
Same, yeah. Sure. And it's interesting to see that we're both around the same number of how many Bergman movies we watched, but they're different.
They are the same, I did check.
Yeah, but they're totally different.
They are. It's because I watched a lot of his earlier works. I don't know why. Like, I watched, like, Crisis. I watched Mr. Sleeman Is Coming, which was a TV short. Just because I saw it on YouTube, it wasn't good. It was like a 50s one-act play that he did, which no one has seen, who I follow. And then, like, Dreams, Prison. It's because when I first watched it, I just went on YouTube. And I was like, oh, there's a Bergman channel. Let me just, you know, watch
all of it, yeah.
Off. Yeah, but now I definitely want to watch specifically Scenes from Marriage is like the priority. You know,
yep, 100%. Yep. And then do Saraband after, because of that connection.
Yeah, because it's a follow-up. And for you, I'll probably say try... The main one you probably have watched is...
The Passion of Anna.
Passion of Anna, is it?
Yeah.
And did you say you've seen The Magician?
I have, yep. So okay. I think it's just Passion of Anna. We covered everything. Thank you, obviously, for coming on as my first guest. I'm genuinely so honored. And I think you brought a lot to the discussion, but is there anything you want to shout out, like your socials or Real Talk? Obviously, shout out to George, Cam, and Tyler. But yeah.
Follow me on TikTok, I guess. Seth's Film Reviews and Real Talk. Yeah. If you want to.
Well, let's call it a day then. Thank you again. Bye, Seth.
Thank you for having me on.
A Capital G Media production. McFly's Movie House is produced by Ghazal El-Hayi and Carmen Fong. Our music is Chunky Monkey by Stryker Big Band. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you want to go above and beyond, please be sure to share on socials. I'm Marta Georgievich, and make sure to come over every Monday to McFly's Movie House for all things cinema, film, and creative. Until then, stay safe and stay curious.